I'd like to move, Mr. Chairman.
What do we just call it? The southern end of the House Revenue Committee to order. Today we have just an informational overview on transportation, recognizing we will probably be seeing some transportation-related legislation come through this committee during the course of the session, and we always do look at things like the cost accountability study and those things. We've already had, of course, one transportation overview. This is
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Before Mazin, before you leave, I wanted to, if I could, Mr. Chairman, Mazin's brought his daughter Natasha down today. She's down visiting the Capitol, and Mazin and Natasha are constituents of mine. She attends Mary Woodward Elementary School, and the reason she's with her dad today is because these are two of the days that the district cut off as a result of their budget cuts. And so she's down at the Capitol today spending time with her dad and learning about the legislative process, and I'm glad she's here.
Welcome. Thank you.
Very nice.
Nice to see you. Okay, back to transportation. Dick, you want to introduce the subject matter, and then we will bring up our friends from the Department of Transportation.
Mr. Chair, Dick Yates, Legislative Revenue. We had sort of planned to have a presentation today on the Highway Cost Allocation Study, and that is not ready, essentially, yet. Hopefully in the next couple of weeks we'll be able to get a presentation on that. In lieu of that, we asked ODOT to come over and talk about primarily the financing of highways and, in general, some of the new policies that they're dealing with respect to their interface with the federal government. And so we have the director of the department here, and Mike Marsh, to give us a presentation.
All right. And at the end of the that presentation, we'll have Olivia Clark in for a few minutes to talk to us about TriMet and some of their transportation issues. So, Mr. Marsh, Mr. Warner, come on forward. Who all is going to be? Whoever, just you all decide.
Good morning, Chairman Shetterly, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thank you for the opportunity to come chat with you this morning about, first off, the needs on the highway and road side. We also have to my right and your left, Paul Mather, who is now in charge of helping us solve our crack bridge problem in Oregon, and we want to have him give you a little update of where we are there. And then on my left and your right is Mike Marsh, who will give you some discussion, some innovative finance, and some of the things we're learning from our other states and using tools from the federal government to help us do things more effectively and efficiently. So we have most of this on PowerPoint today, and you can see it there, and I believe you should also have a copy of this in front of you. So let me start. I think what you see...
Sorry, if I could ask Kathy to bring the lights down in the... Okay, here we go.
What this says is transportation system update. This is very similar to a presentation that we gave the House Transportation Committee last week, and it really is titled a little bit incorrectly because really what I wanted to talk, what I was told, is you wanted to understand some of the needs on the highway, road, and street side, in other words, the state, city, county side. And so this presentation I'm going to give you an overview does not include public transit, does not include rail, heavy rail, or passenger rail in terms of freight rail, doesn't include marine, air, some of the other things that are vital to the transportation system. So if you want to get some of that information, we can work with you to get some other folks to talk to you about that. So let me just proceed on. What I thought was important is for you to just understand when you look at the highway and road system in the state of Oregon, there are really three main players in that, and obviously that's the state, the counties, and the cities. And if you look at the road system, the highway system we have in the state, there's about 7,500 miles of state highway. And the way I characterize this is we have about 10% of the actual road mileage, but we carry over 60% of the actual traffic mileage and vehicle miles traveled in the state on those highways. The other one, which I think is important, most people don't realize, is the counties have the largest portion of the road system in the state of Oregon. You can see 27,300 miles. The city's 9,200 miles. And then becoming more and more of an issue and importance, I think, are people recognizing there's 6,500 bridges out there on all of those systems. And some of those bridges are in trouble, which you'll hear about in a moment. This is just a slide that's meant to show you that there's been a considerable amount of work done over the years to identify what's really needed to adequately fund operations, maintenance, preservation, and modernization of all of these systems. And in 1993, the cities and counties and state worked together on a roads finance study and concluded that really we ought to have about $1.9 billion over that biennium period, 93-95, to adequately fund the system. And I believe Legislative Fiscal Office did an analysis in 1999 and showed that that had increased to $2.6 billion for the 2003-2005 biennium. The important thing is just that if you look at this, the gap is growing, and this and these numbers do not include some of the discussions of the bridges that you're going to hear about again in a moment. Just to again highlight the kind of needs versus the revenues available, I want to put this up to give the legislature credit for first off passing the 2001 Oregon Transportation Investment Act, but to also recognize that provided $400 million originally, which ultimately turned out to be $500 million, and then was actually leveraged to almost $650 million worth of investment in the transportation system. But we put out a request per the direction of the legislature to get projects which were ready to go, had no environmental or land use fatal flaws that we could actually move forward with. So we asked people for their high priority projects, and for $400 million worth of available revenue, just those high priority, quick, ready to go projects, we received $1.5 billion worth of requests. And you can see down at the bottom of that graphic where the money was actually allocated for the first $400 million, and that's changed again as a result of later legislative action. And then you can see the requests. And it's important to note those far right-hand side, the requests, we actually went to that list and were able to capture more of those as a result of the increased bonding authority you folks gave us in OTIA 2, I guess is what we would like to call it. The other thing I think you folks in the Revenue Committee are very keenly aware of, that inflation has a great impact on our ability to address those needs. And from 1990 to 2000, this graphic shows that there was an average of about 2.75% per year increase in the inflation rate dealing with the highway construction and maintenance functions that we do. So what that means is a dollar spent in 1990 costs actually about $1.32 to provide those same services and materials. And if you look at that in terms of the amount of federal and state revenues coming to our department, that equates to about $17.2 million per year that is lost due to inflation. And to put that into perspective, that's about 0.7 of 1 cent of a gallon of gas tax is lost every year. And over the last decade, we've the city, state, and the counties have received no additional revenues for operations and maintenance. So you can see that we've been dealing with that inflation over that time. Just to give you some ideas, if you look at where some of the major components of our cost to maintain and preserve our system, obviously wages, but the thing people don't think about is materials. And just for an example, last year, and I suspect this is even greater now, the cost of liquid asphalt, which is the cement that binds asphaltic concrete together, went up 44% last year alone. And that doesn't mean that the price of asphaltic concrete went up 44%, but one of the major building blocks did go up. Engineering costs go up, but that's mainly related to wages. And right away, this is the one people don't think about, but when we need to do modernization or projects to add capacity, especially in the urban areas, right now, many of our modernization projects in the developed areas of the state, we actually spend more on right-of-way acquisition than we do on the actual construction project itself. The next slide is meant to show, again, kind of the double whammy that happens in transportation, which is the effect of rising fuel efficiency. And we want rising fuel efficiency. We want the automobiles to be more efficient. And this just shows that in 1970, the light vehicle fleet in the state of Oregon got about 11.8 miles per gallon on the average. In the year 2000, that went up to almost 20 miles per gallon. And the next slide is just meant that if you put the combined effect of inflation and increased fuel efficiency together, in actual real dollar cents, people are paying about half today what they did in 1970 on a per mile basis, which is an interesting way to look at this. We want all these vehicles to be fuel efficient, but here's some of the effects. And this next slide is just meant to show you the very bottom line shows you the revenues that we have coming from the state highway trust fund, our truck weight mile, gasoline taxes, and other fees, you can see that a little less than $400 million is generated by that source. And I want to also call your attention that from about 1992 to present, you can see that essentially the line has been very, very flat in terms of the revenue. And the next two lines, the next one up, was just meant to show you that if you had that same amount of a tax being generated without taking into account fuel economy, you can see that all of a sudden you'd have almost $900 million worth of revenue available if the fleet was still getting the mileage it did in 1970. And then the final line is just showing you what would happen if you had accounted or indexing or taken into account inflation with the fuel tax and other revenues. You can see you have over $1 billion annually to take care of things. So just wanted to point out that 1-2 punch has a great deal of impact on the viability of our revenues to meet our needs. The other thing I think from your standpoint you're very interested in is population has increased. Number of vehicles registered in Oregon has increased. 18% population increased essentially over the last decade. Number of passenger vehicles registered actually has increased greater than the population as a whole. It's 27% increase. And if you turn to if we go to the next slide, you can see that vehicle miles traveled on the public roads has actually increased 28%, even over the amount of increased vehicles. And this is good. It actually, for many years, the vehicle miles traveled were increasing 30% above the population and registered vehicle increases. The final thing I think is important for you to understand is if you look at the state, county, and city miles of road, actual miles of road out there, you can see that essentially over the last decade, the mileage of roads has remained constant. It's gone up 2%. During that period, and that is even, I think, distorts it a bit because I suspect if you look at the numbers, that 2% relate really back to subdivision roadways, local new roads built in cities to deal with housing that are just servicing the houses on those roadways. And obviously, if you increase the miles traveled with no increases in travel lanes or a number of roadways, that will relate to congestion. And this next slide just shows you over that same decade about the amount of miles of freeway that are congested. And anybody who drives in the Portland area knows what freeway congestion is. It's showing that about 41% increase in the miles that are congested during that same time period. And this is of great concern to people who have to move freight and goods around the state of Oregon and through the state of Oregon. Additional challenges, these are just some examples, maybe starting from the bottom. The first three from the bottom up really reflect during that decade, we've had a number of new mandates, rightfully so, that we needed to deal with. The Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act requirements are kicking in. And we need to look at things like how we're going to make sure that our culverts allow fish to get from the ocean to their spawning grounds. And we actually are doing some good things in that area. If you want to know about that, I can tell you. The Endangered Species Act itself limits when we can actually get into the rivers and streams to do crossings for bridges and so on. And then there's other things that we need to do during construction and permanently to maintain the water quality. But I think the biggest thing is the very first bullet that you need to be aware of. Our system is becoming old. Much of the system we have today, the major system, was built in the late 40s, 50s, and early 60s, and it's 40 and 50 years old, and that is becoming a real issue. The last slide, this is meant to show, again, that we're all in this together, the cities, the counties, and the state. And if you looked at what was really necessary to maintain and preserve the system adequately, you would need, at the very bottom right of that, almost an additional $500 million annually to maintain and preserve the system adequately. If the cities and counties were here today at the table talking with you, they would give you examples of how their maintenance budgets have been held flat for the last decade. And in essence, there's many counties right now that are looking at reverting paved roadways back to gravel, some of the ones that they actually paved in the 70s and 80s, and converting back to gravel. And a number of the cities are finding that their roadway system is starting to deteriorate. And overall, the system is deteriorating. And you can see the various needs by the jurisdictions. And obviously that's a considerable amount of dollars. And I think we've done some really good things over the last decade to be more effective and efficient with the dollars we have. And we have a lot of partnerships that weren't in place as a result of this. So there is some real benefit. This final slide that I have before I turn it over to Mr. Mather just shows some of the things that people take for granted when they're talking about the highway and road system. These are things, the maintenance that people expect to be done. Things like, again, making sure the roadways are patched and there's no potholes, making sure that bridges are inspected and maintained so that they don't wash out during times of high water. Snow and ice removal, one of the big portions of our budget. We actually have been pretty good this year until the last few weeks in terms of expenditures there. But the other things like traffic services, like signing, striping, just paying for the energy and street lights and traffic lights are things that people don't understand. And down at the very bottom right, storm repairs. I think this has really hit home as a result of some of the amount of rain we've had recently. We need to deal with debris removal, slide repairs, and washout repairs, and we have a number of those going on right now. I think some of you are aware that Highway 101 is shut down again in the same spot it has been in recent times, and we're trying to get that open. But those are the things that, again, people take for granted. This does not show the major preservation needs, which when I want to make that clear, is we need to go out and do major pavement rehabilitation, bridge deck replacements and things just to keep the system operating in good condition. And so that's above and beyond the maintenance side. And obviously above and beyond the modernization or the expansion of the system, which mostly all of you get lobbied about, saying, I want my particular interchange improved or a road widened or a signal included. So none of those dollars included in that. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think I would stop there, and I'd be happy to answer questions, or I can turn it over to Paul, and we can keep walking through the presentation and save your questions up.
Okay. Are there questions now, or shall we continue?
I have one.
Representative Bridges.
Mr. Chairman, could you explain to me what you see as your relationship to counties and cities? What is your department's relationship in terms of responsibility?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, if I'm catching the and correct me if I'm not getting to what you're looking for. Clearly, we are a partner in a transportation system with our local governments. Our system does not work without their system, and their system does not work without ours. We operate different systems because of the geographic and because of the political boundaries. They receive, as you know, portions of funds dedicated for their use from the state revenues, and some of them actually get federal revenues. They usually maintain and preserve their own roadways, but what I was trying to get at, when you look at where we are today and over the last decade, we have many, many places throughout the state of Oregon where we have essentially dissolved some of those political and geographic boundaries from the standpoint of service provision. There's many places where we share equipment, and if you go out and look at a roadway being worked on in the Portland metro area or in the Medford area, Jackson County, you'll see equipment owned by all of the agencies out working on a particular job. And in fact, in the Medford area, we actually have joint facilities, which is what I really like to get to, Representative Berger, if I'm getting to your question, because people don't care whether it's a city road, a county road, or a state highway. They want one number to call. They want somebody to take care of their problem. And I think we're, as a result of budgets being lean, we're doing things like that we've never done before. So I think we are a partner. We are also somebody that helps them as need be. We continue to work effectively with them to look at what are the right roadways for us to maintain and for they to maintain, so that we're not duplicating efforts in a particular area. Did I answer your question?
You did.
Okay.
You did.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Farr.
Thank you. We have 7,500 miles of state highways. Does that include the interstate system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Farr, yes, it does.
Thank you.
You were supposed to take longer.
one more question, if I may. Actually, just a comment. The joint facilities, I'm particularly intrigued with that. I'm from Eugene, and it seems to me we have a lot of duplication of effort down there, duplication of equipment, at least. Thank you.
Okay, and a free cup of coffee to anyone who can identify that bridge. Or Diet Coke.
Isn't that in the Columbia Gorge?
No.
I'm guessing Southern Oregon.
Southern?
No.
No, it's in the Columbia Gorge, isn't it?
No. Well, it's not the Soviet Union.
Okay, go.
This is what we call Corey's Bridge, which is just outside of La Grande. They're in the canyon, coming out of La Grande towards Pendleton. The bridge you see in the far background, kind of lower, is actually a railroad bridge.
That's what confused me.
Corey's Bridge.
My name is Paul Mather. I'm a regional manager for the Department of Transportation, responsible for Southwest Oregon. For the last 6 months, I've been responsible for leading a team in the department and working with local governments to put together a strategy to deal with the crisis that we face in the state with our bridges. And today I want to give you a presentation on our report that we released to our commission back in January, and then talk to you about recommendations that are in that report. What I want to do today is just talk about the bridge conditions itself and just how we got to the place where we're at. Talk about freight issues and how important freight is and the relationship to the bridge problem that we're talking about. When we did the report, we were trying to translate this bridge problem into economic problems and livability problems into terms that people could understand. And so I want to talk to you about some of the things that we did in that regard, and then end up with our recommendations that we have in the report. So we'll start with background with bridges. This slide's actually an important slide to remember as we go through the entire presentation. As Bruce has been talking about, we really looked at this from a system-wide standpoint, both local bridges and state bridges. On this graph, you'll see the local bridges are represented by the gold color, and blue is representing the state bridges. This really gives you a picture of the demographics of the bridges in the state. Typically, bridges last between 50 to 100 years, and there's a number of different factors that determine their life, from environmental conditions, traffic conditions, design issues, a number of things. But you can see pretty dramatically on this graph, we have a wave in our demographic of bridges are ready to crash into that 50 to 100 year life that we typically expect bridges to last. And it's really kind of the foundation for the presentation. One of the things that's actually, we've seen this kind of wave coming at us for some time. It's not a new thing for us. But in the last few years, what has been new for us, it has accelerated this problem for us, is a particular design that we used in the late 50s and early 60s that didn't compensate enough for the shear that a particular beam experiences as weights go over it. And those are cracking. And these bridges are entering that 50 to 100 year life, but just barely before they fail. So they're failing sooner than what we would expect. What this map here shows you is where those bridges are around the state that are showing the shear cracks on our system. The blue ones on this map are ones that we've actually posted. This map we did as part of the study back in August or September, so there's actually a few more blue dots that should be on here that aren't. Mm-hmm. On the local side of the system, you'll see here they too have the same design that was used during that same time period and are showing the same cracking phenomenon, and they have dramatically more posted bridges on the local system than on the state system. To give you a little bit of perspective in that last 5 years time period, in 1997 we had no emergency repairs on the state system, but we had 42 load restrictions. These 42 load restrictions were largely on our district highways, our secondary highways, weren't a major concern to us in relative to freight. In 2000, that increased to 13 emergency repairs that we had in our system and 49 load restrictions. Of those 49 now, we were seeing over a half a dozen of those being on the interstate system or on major freight routes. As we turn ahead to 2003, by the end of this year, we're expecting 140 bridges on the state system, or about 5% of our bridges, to be posted. Based on current funding, our projections are by the 2010 that number will grow to 850, or about 30% of our system. Just talking about some of the recent bridge emergencies that we experienced over that same time period, Corey's Bridge, the one you saw the photograph at the beginning of the presentation, was one of the first ones that we recognized. It was a bridge on the interstate system that restricted trucks across that bridge. Coles Bridge is another one in Eastern Oregon near John Day that restricted access to a mill. That the limit on that bridge actually went down to 26,000 pounds at one point. A mill owner in John Day estimated that the 130-mile detour was costing him $30,000 a day for that increased travel. Ford's Bridge in Southern Oregon is one I'm very familiar with. We actually posted a bridge on the freeway down to 64,000 pounds, which essentially affects all truck traffic. And for about a three-week time period, we had basically all the truck traffic on I-5 going through downtown Riddle and downtown Canyonville, which represented some pretty interesting times for us.
Tell them the numbers. I think
it's nearly 2,000 trucks a day going through downtown Riddle and Canyonville, and those that are familiar with those two communities. They're fairly small communities.
Well, what do I hear about the trucks 99W through Monroe? What's the story there? Something coming or...
Mr. Chairman, we did put a restriction on bridges over the Willamette and the McKinsey in the Eugene area on I-5. Those restrictions aren't near as severe as the one that I've been describing so far, but they do affect a significant amount of trucks, the heavier trucks, and there is a detour that is posted to put those trucks through communities such as Junction City and Monroe and other communities.
And that's in place now?
Correct.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just kind of put an economic base on that. You have restrictions on, I believe, it's Isthmus Slough Bridge in my area, where Weyerhaeuser is losing thousands of dollars because of the inability to move those trucks because of the restrictions. You can't have two trucks on the bridge at the same time, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that, you know, we need to somehow kind of tie the real dollar figure from the economy standpoint.
Did you say Isthmus Slough?
Uh-huh.
That's perverse.
you don't know how to speak that language?
Isthmus Slough.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. How about Blossom Gulch?
I can do that.
Okay.
As I go further in my presentation, I'll get to some of those economic impacts, and you'll be able to see from a statewide basis as well as a regional basis what those impacts are. As we began to work on this problem, last spring, we put together a task force to begin just helping us understand what the problem is, how big it is, and how to approach it. This group of experts validated that we do have a problem with the particular design that I've been describing. They also recommend that we shift our way of selecting bridge projects away from a worst first on a list of where's the worst bridge in the state down to the next list to a corridor approach, recognizing as we have one bridge in a corridor that's restricted, then the whole corridor becomes restricted. So we need to look from a corridor standpoint and a freight system standpoint in our approach to bridges. They also recommended that we start with I-5 and 84 first as the top priority. Things we've done on the funding side in the last 5 years, as we've seen this problem coming and then growing, we've made changes in our program and nearly doubled the amount of money that we spent on bridges. That increase in funding for bridges has come at the expense of modernization, maintenance, preservation, and other parts of our program. OTIA funding from last session has been a big help for us. As you see, the map there shows the bridges on the freeway that we've been able to construct because of the OTIA funding. With OTIA 1 and OTIA 2 money, there's nearly $200 million were put towards bridges. $60 million of that went towards local bridges. Talk a little bit about the freight background and how that interplays with the bridge issues. I think to nobody's surprise, trucks are the major component of our freight system. Just because of their flexibility and mobility compared to rail, air, and water, they're the dominant mobility, moving freight in our system. Nearly 70% are carried by truck. But the more important part is in that little blue box, I think, there at the top, where nearly a third of the freight that's carried on trucks are actually carried in loads that are over 80,000 pounds. And you go through the presentation, you'll see that those particular loads are very critical to Oregon's economy, in particular to the economy in more remote and rural parts of our state. Just to understand a little bit of what I'm talking about when we talk about loads over 80,000 pounds, there are two types of loads that we talk about over 80,000 pounds. Those that are indivisible or not being able to take apart, which are largely construction equipment, logging equipment, bridge beams, those type of things that you're not easily able to take apart, but you still need to move throughout the state. Then there's also divisible loads. These are loads that can be broken down into smaller loads, but again, because of the efficiency factors involved, they're highly dependent on the economy to have these loads available on our system. They're recognizable typically by truck and trailer combinations that you see on the road, or even the triple trailers are probably the most recognizable one, but they're basically loads that are over any loads over about five axles, or the 80,000 pound loads on our system.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a side question. Is there any data on the safety of the triple trailer rigs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hobson, I'm sure there is. I don't have that at my fingertips, but we can get that for you.
Okay, thank you.
just talk about some of the commodities that are carried in these loads that I've been describing. The gold part on here focuses in on those loads that are over 80,000 pounds that are, again, critical to the economy. A couple examples for you just to get a feel for what these loads are. The chemical fuels, the worst one you see, is a fairly big component in these loads. An example that's in there are the gasoline and diesel fuels that are hauled to gas stations throughout the state of Oregon. There's two pipeline outlets in the state, one in Portland, one in Eugene, and virtually every gas station in the state is served from those pipelines with truck and trailer combinations that are 105 5-pound loads delivering to every gas station in the state. If we were having to restrict our bridges to 80,000 pounds, this industry would have to retool to a fleet of 80,000-pound loads, put additional trucks on the roadways, increase costs for the transport of the fuel, and those costs would likely be passed on to consumers. The next one down, forest, lumber, and furniture, is another big component. Here, this represents a large component of mills that we have, lumber mills throughout the state, that are in economic competition with the rest of the Western United States as well as Canada. These remote mills need an efficient form of transportation for them to stay economically competitive. So where do these loads come from? As you see in this map, I think, again, to nobody's surprise, that their large portion is generated out of the Portland metro area, with Portland being the economic engine of the state. There's no surprise that the majority of these loads originate out of the Portland metro area. But to really understand the real importance of these particular loads, you really need to look at the economies regionally around the state and how important they are. And that really turns almost those numbers upside down from what you saw in the previous slide. Areas in eastern Oregon, central Oregon, southern Oregon, and on the coast are very dependent locally on these roads, and almost inversely, as you see on here, the Portland metro area is less dependent on these loads. Again, the more rural, remote areas of the state with agricultural products, lumber, aggregate, these are the loads that are important to those localized economies from around the state. We'll talk about some of the things now we learned specifically in the study. First of all, we have nearly a $5 billion problem. If we're going to address all the bridge problems that we're projecting for the next 10 years, remove all the restrictions from our system, it's going to cost us nearly $5 billion to do that.
They're a state, city, and county?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Without an investment, we're going to see the trucking industry add more trips as truckloads are limited. As those are limited to 80,000 pounds, we're going to see that 30% that I've been talking about be impacted. As those restrictions kind of go down to the next level, down to 64,000 pounds, then we're going to see about 90% of the truck's tons shipped impacted. The economic effect that this has in the Oregon economy is up to $122 billion between now and 2025. The potential jobs that represents is nearly 88,000 that would be lost. To give you some perspective to both those numbers, Intel is one of Oregon's largest employers. They do about $5 or $6 billion annually in the state. On the job side, in 1978, at the peak of the timber industry, they employed about 81,000 jobs in the state. So you can see, relative to both those numbers of 122 billion and 88,000 jobs, are very significant numbers for the state. And again, as I've been talking about, these impacts are even more intense or more realized in the localized economies around the state. In southern Oregon, in the Rogue Valley in particular, which has the highest concentration of these crack bridges, they have some very severe economic impacts just because of the severe limitations that they would be under. In central Oregon, again, just because of geographically where they're located in the center of the state and have to travel throughout the state networks just to get into other states' transportation systems, they would also be impacted. It's also important to recognize that Portland is often the gateway for a lot of our commerce going to and from the state, and it's important to keep that transportation functioning for the entire state.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Thompson.
Thank you. Why is it that the Rogue Valley area has the highest incidence of crack bridges?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hobson, it has to do largely with the time period that the interstate was built, okay, and many of the bridges were built. They were built during this particular time period I've been describing, the late 50s and early 60s. Not only do we have an economic problem, but we also have a livability problem. Those that have lived through these bridge emergencies that we've had around the state understand the impacts we have on downtowns, on schools, on neighborhoods. As we put trucks on roads that aren't designed for them, either structurally designed for trucks or geometrically designed for trucks, we see safety risks increase, and we see maintenance costs for both the local governments as well as the state increase.
Okay, where was that?
This is Baker City.
Okay. You didn't give us time. But
I know what this one is.
This one gives you a point.
Well, you passed the reading test.
We are a sharp committee.
This one just talks a little bit about the impacts directly on the industry itself. In the short term, the trucking industry, as we have this kind of random locations that are shut down or restricted to bridges, they're forced to lighten their loads, they're forced to detour. All those things increase costs, which are passed on to consumers. In the long term, the industry will force to be looking at things such as retooling their fleets, possibly relocating outside of Oregon, or our economic model we use actually suggested in some cases they would move to the edges of the state to still serve Oregon, but to utilize transportation systems outside of Oregon. But again, the bottom line, costs will increase and be passed on to consumers. Now we'll talk about the recommendations. Obviously, with these kind of impacts, our recommendation is to start investing and start tackling this problem that we have today to minimize the effects that we have on the economy and hardships on our communities. We developed four key priorities as we put our recommendation together. First is to fix the interstate and keep the trucks off the local streets. Fix important freight routes that link to the interstate system. Fix economically critical city and county bridges that link to this network that we're constructing. And the last one, as we build this network for freight around the state, there's going to be bridges that are going to be lower priority or left behind through this. We need to develop an emergency funding source that we can keep minimal services open through all communities throughout the state. Our recommendation is a staged approach. As we were building the stage approach, our assumptions were we needed to get this done within the next 10 years. As we look back now in our stage approach that we recommended, we actually think we can get it done sooner than that in more like 7 years. To develop the stage approach, we used an iterative process, talking with industry, freight, and key manufacturers and what their needs were from throughout the state. We had a statewide economic model that helped us understand the statewide impacts for the different alternatives that we were considering as well as regional impacts. We did a survey with city and county bridges to understand the local needs on their systems. We built an information database within our own bridges that we have in the state system to understand every segment of every state highway throughout the state, to understand what it took to get each segment up to different critical levels. So it was 80,000 pounds, 105,000, or the single trip or any load point, and able to use an iterative process back and forth through that to understand the cost benefits or the economic benefits versus the cost of particular links in our system. As we built that, we released a draft report last January to our commission. As we presented that to them, they gave us feedback that in our original draft that our staged approach did not fix the interstate fast enough, that they wanted us to focus more on the interstate than what we have done. And they asked us to reach out throughout more of Oregon and see if we could reach more parts of Oregon with our recommendation that was in the original five stage approach. So what I'm going to present to you today is actually a revised recommendation that what you may have seen in our earlier draft report. Our first stage of our five-stage approach is the same as what's in the original draft, is to construct provide a link for freight and trucks to use Highway 97 from California north to Madras and Highway 26 over Mount Hood to I-205 and through Central Oregon from Bend to Ontario via Highway 20. While the interstate is our first priority, this stage is important to us for a couple of reasons. First, it is something that we can do within our existing funds. Second, it provides an economic link to the economic engine of the state, Portland, and provides a north-south, east-west connection through the state that can be done within existing funds. Also, it provides an alternative route as we turn to the interstate in later stages and do major, more intensive work on the interstate system. It provides an alternative route for trucks to use while we have construction activity happening on the interstate. This slide gives you some of the attributes of stage one as well as the cost breakdown of the different routes. as we were going through the different staging and even in the last couple of months as we've been going through and reordering these, it's been difficult for us to get down to the very detail we need on the local bridge side to understand the city and county needs. So we've made some assumptions as we've gone through this. Our assumptions have been, as a stage went through a particular city that had a bridge need on it, we included their bridge needs in that stage. Likewise, in the county system, as a stage passed within 5 miles of a bridge that was recognized as being needed to repair, we included that in the stage. Looking back on the list that generated, we know that that's the wrong list, but it gives us a starting place. Once we get the five-stage and the state system nailed down, we can do more specific investigation on the local side to make sure that, again, from a strategic standpoint, we're reaching the right bridges. Our second stage focuses on our main priority, which is the interstate. In this stage, we do all of I-84, and we do I-5 from I-205 in Portland, south of Eugene, to Highway 58. We also include Highway 58 in this. As you'll see in the next slide, the more intense portion of our work is actually in the southern portion of I-5. Highway 58 gives us another link for traffic, freight traffic, to use before we start heavy construction on the southern portion of I-5. This gives you kind of the attributes of Stage 2 as well as the cost. You notice the cost on Stage 2 are dramatically more than they were in stage 1. Stage 3, we simply complete I-5 from Highway 58 south of Eugene to the California border. Again, the attributes in here, you can see how expensive just that relatively the southern portion of the southern half of I-5 is almost as expensive as the balance of the interstate system.
So you're replacing 85 bridges from Highway 58 south to California?
57. Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And you add that to the 16 that you're repairing, is that about all the bridges?
Mr. Chairman, that's many of the bridges. That's not all of them, but as we go through this, it's been an understanding for me to recognize how many bridges we actually have in our interstate system. By the time you have the overpasses, you have the interchanges, many of the crossings are actually two bridges at one spot where the freeway is separated apart, and you have two bridges in one location compared to a two-lane route where you don't have near the overcrossings, interchanges, or those multiple bridges. In Stage 4, now we start building that network that reaches out beyond the interstate. In this recommendation, we begin focusing on major economic place importance in our economy. The coast is one of those places that we focused on. The Port of Astoria is connected via Highway 30 through Longview and I-5. Newport connected via Highway 20.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just a clarification. On the tally of bridges here, does it include bridges over the interstate as well as the actual bridges on the interstate? Overpasses. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Farr, that was one of the things that we really took a critical look at when we did the interstate. It does not include all the overpasses. It does not include all the interchanges. We tried to look from a very strategic standpoint which ones were key, most important, and really compared that to routes such as you're seeing here in Stage 4. If we had a trade-off of doing this overpass, which may be relatively low volume, versus opening up several hundred miles of state highway in eastern Oregon, try to do those trade-offs from an economic standpoint and pick the one strategically that offered us the best gain.
Thank you.
So in Stage 4, we, again, connect to the coast. Highway 38 and Highway 42 to the coast are on here. As well as many north-south routes through eastern Oregon to provide those farm-to-market routes linking into the system that we're building. Here's the list of bridges that are constructed in Stage 4. As you see, the cost now come down fairly dramatically, down to just over $200 million to do these list of routes. Also, as we build this network off the interstate and we start to kind of cross the state, we come across routes that don't have any bridge needs on them, and they're linked into the system that we're creating. So almost for free or no cost, that here's a list of routes that are also able to be connected into this network that we're building. As we went to Stage 5 in our revised recommendation, we shifted our thinking a little bit from the first four stages as well as from our original recommendation. In the first four phases or stages that you've seen from me, they've been built to accommodate any load or those single trip permits from construction equipment, logging equipment, and so forth. But recognizing that they represent a relatively small percentage of our trucks, 1, 2, 3%, we really wanted to focus in on those loads, those 30% or the 105 5-pound loads that are economically critical to our state. So we dropped stage five down a notch. These routes aren't able to accommodate every load, but they're able to accommodate about 95, 98% of our loads that we have on our system. The thinking was, in the first four stages, we've built a good network throughout the state for the single trip permits. Now let's go back and see if we can get as much economic gain as we can with our investment. So these routes you see in stage five are routes that will be able to accommodate those 105 5-pound loads, but not the single trip permit loads. As you can see, there's a fairly long list of routes that we're able to get to with this type of thinking. And again, a relatively small cost for just over $100 million, we're able to get to a fair amount of routes. And like in the previous stage, again, we're able to connect into other routes now that don't require any improvements, but are able to connect into this network that we're building. So as you look at all five stages, you're able to see we have a network of roadways now throughout the state that is able to accommodate various types of roadways. But it does not include all the state. As I've talked about, one of our priorities was emergency funding for those bridges that aren't included in these five stages. If we did stage one only and stopped there, our estimates for emergency funding that we would need on the rest of our system is $800 million. Obviously, as we repair or fix more of our system, those numbers go down. If we repair all five stages of our recommendation, that number drops down to $300 million needed to triage the rest of the system for the next 10 years. So in summary, we have our four key priorities: fix the interstate to keep trucks off the local streets, fix important freight routes, fix economically critical local bridges, and develop a funding strategy for triaging the rest of the system. Our recommendation is based on funding all five stages. If we were to drop back to only fund partial stages, we need to go back and apply these criteria to a new recommendation. As you look at our entire recommendation with our triage funding, emergency funding, along with the total funding needed for five stages, our total package includes $2 billion. Our recommendation is both strategic and cost-effective. Oregon's key freight routes remain viable with this recommendation. We minimize the impact on communities as we keep trucks on the freight routes and on the interstate where they're designed to be. Our recommendation provides a strategic first step in solving Oregon's bridge crisis. As we look back at our economic model and apply these five-stage recommendations to our model, we see about 90% of the economic benefit to the state as a whole relative to fixing every bridge in the state. So indeed, we think we have a recommendation that is both strategic and cost-effective. To give you some idea on the funding side, our assumptions that we were putting this together would be a bonding package that we'd be very aggressive in rebuilding these bridges. To support the bonds needed to fund the recommendation, we need an annual funding source of about $115 million annually. Assuming that we take $25 million of that from our existing bridge program, additional new revenue source would need to be about $90 million. The remainder of our existing bridge program would then turn into this emergency or triage funding that I've been talking about. So in summary, we're going to see negative impacts on the economy with no investment that could increase to $122 billion impact by 2025 or 88,000 jobs potentially lost. Communities are going to be impacted. Our recommendation that we have minimizes these economic impacts and maintains Oregon's key freight routes and provides a first key strategic step in solving this nearly $5 billion bridge problem. And lastly, this bridge investment stimulates Oregon's economy. As I said, we think we can get this done within the next 7 to 10 years, and this will generate over $1 billion in wages back into Oregon's economy.
Okay.
With that.
Questions? Representative Bergen.
Your stages are based on today's industry and trucking needs and so forth that you've looked at. What about, how is it going to be affected, for instance, if in my area we were to receive two large companies or even equal the size of American Bridge that then required trucking? Wouldn't that change the stage?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Verger. I believe as you look on this map here when we're done, both Highway 38 and 42 would be able to accommodate any single trip permit load with our strategy. As far as timing of this, it's critical to note that while we may get 38 done, we need the interstate done first for the traffic to get from 38 to or right. from Reedsport or from Coos Bay to its ultimate destination. Yeah. So that's why our strategies, our stages are in order of starting kind of from the inside and working out, starting with the interstate system first and then building this network that builds upon that.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hess.
Thank you. I know in the last session there was some legislation, I think, with Washington County to try to basically saying, you know, it's a little bit like education. If the state isn't going to fund this, then give us some leeway and let us improve some of these roads. So is there any more analysis of doing that? And I, obviously that would be not the preferred way to go, but I can see that happening more and more if the legislature doesn't address some of these things. I just wondered what your thoughts were.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, Haas, right?
Either way.
if I understand your question, what you're saying is without additional money to solve this bridge problem, essentially give local governments additional revenue to spend the way they seem fit to maintain the economy in that area. Is that essentially the...
Yeah, there was legislation to do that in 2001. I think it might have even passed one chamber or the other, but...
Mr. Chairman, I don't remember that particular bill, but it is clear that the needs that we're talking about here are over and above the normal operations, maintenance, and preservation of the system, both at the state level and the city and county. And as I tried to set the stage, the cities, counties are really feeling the impact of no additional investment and revenues for just those ongoing maintenance and preservation needs. What I think, if I remember right, I'm getting back to the bill, which I think was Representative Ringo's bill, which was talking about essentially taking some money off the top and allowing cities to look at various priorities, economic development or otherwise, in their particular communities. And that's an option. The problem is, of course, then you take away the revenues that are available for some of the other things that many of the folks here at this table want to see in their particular communities. So what we were doing was essentially dividing the pie up differently and taking more of it off the top and saying, let's go to this particular area. But if I remember right, the bill was also trying to encourage investment in transportation by saying, let's use those dollars and say you can only access those dollars if you matched it dollar for dollar or something like that. So the intent was, I think, to get additional revenue for transportation by encouraging local investment. The problem was, without additional revenue, that $25 million, I think it was, on an annual basis, was coming away from other modernization projects that throughout the state. And right now, we're spending only about $50 million a year on modernization statewide. So you essentially be cutting the state-funded modernization in half, if I'm answering your question.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, just to follow up on Representative Berger's point, that I mean, I could see local governments getting into the situation where if they just fixed that one bridge near that one mill, it would take care of a huge problem. And I could see them doing that in the absence of a larger statewide funding package. And get into all those sort of those school formula local option kind of fights.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There have been some proposals lately, and if I remember correctly, a couple of them have come from Congressman DeFazio. And the two that I recall, one of them would put a weight limit of 80,000 pounds on divisible loads, and the other, if I remember it, would suggest that more of the freight traffic, especially the heavy traffic, would travel by rail. I wonder if you have an analysis of what that would do economically, and if so, could I get a copy of that? Because I think those are important questions, both from a political and from an economic point of view. And well, I guess the third part of that question is, would limiting weight loads to 80,000 pounds for divisible loads actually make any difference in terms of the work that needs to be done and the cost of it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, as we were working through this study, we looked at many of those questions. And they're key questions to understand and to debate the impacts of each one of those. The first, I think, is to understand when we talk about those loads over 80,000 pounds, we're talking about two groups, the divisible loads and the loads that aren't divisible. As we look back at our bridge problem, why I said that first demographic chart that shows the ages of our bridges is important, we have bridges that are going to fail and not be able to accommodate any load. The assumption, I think, in Representative DeFazio's proposal was that we would still be able to accommodate these heavier indivisible loads. The reality of our condition of our bridges, they're not going to be able to accommodate any loads, you know, over 80,000 or over 64,000. So from a policy standpoint, once we get our bridges back into a condition, if we want to extend the life of bridges beyond that, I think there's merits to considering that. But given the crisis that we're in, we're at a stage where we're going to limit all loads over 80,000 pounds, all load over 64,000 pounds, regardless of whether divisible or indivisible loads. We did do the economic analysis just theoretically. If we did limit loads to 80,000 pounds in our system, what the economic impacts of that would be. Those numbers are in our report. I believe they're on the order of about $20 billion between now and 2025 and about 14,000 jobs. So they're dramatically less than the $122 billion that I talked about in the 88,000, but they're still very significant and very much more impact than what we're talking about in way of an investment in bridges.
Representative Berger.
Let me see if I can phrase this right. We're talking about a transportation system, and we're only a piece of it. I remember when the bridges were built in Southern Oregon, it was construction for, you know, about 20 years of my life. You didn't go to Southern Oregon because they were building bridges, and clearly there were construction issues that these are only 50-year bridges. So I have one real quick question. What's the lifespan of the new bridge, the 217 bridge that just completed? This is just a quick. What'd you build that to, gentlemen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, that bridge was built to current standards and based on current loads we have in our system. We expect that bridge to last between 75 to 100 years. It is built to current seismic and current load standards. But again, the bridges that we were talking about even in the 60s were built to those current standards and those loads at that time.
Yeah, but the bigger question is this. Suppose we get to stage three and we rebuild those. What are they doing in Northern California? What are they doing in Idaho? We're part of a grid, and if and the whole system could break, we could spend a fortune in Southern Oregon and have it stop at Weed in terms of the interstate big load piece. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Burge, the bridge problem that we see throughout the nation, there is a dramatic bridge problem. What we have, though, particularly in Oregon, again, driven in the short term by this particular design that we used in the 50s and 60s, we have dramatically more urgent critical bridges than our neighboring states in Washington, Idaho, and California. While they still have the overall demographics of bridges that are going to be hitting them, of bridges that were built during the heavy interstate period, theirs is much more leveled out and not near as spiked as critical as ours is, driven by that design feature.
Representative Virtue, you
have a question? I do. I'd like to shift now to bidding. Let's say that you have all the money that you ever dreamed you might have, and so you're going to go out and do a lot of things. There was a lot of criticism in my area of the state when a company from Florida painted the North Bend Bridge. And I started inquiring as to just exactly how the bidding process works. And I'd like for you to talk a little bit about that, because I'm wondering if you think there are any changes that the legislature needs to make. Is it possible legally to make them? We have American Bridge at Reedsport, and if American Bridge is going to be in the bidding process, are they always going to lose to some out-of-state company, and then we're not really putting Argonians to work? So that's kind of another little topic here I'd like for you to address.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, really, really good question. One of the things that, that we view is obviously we've got a problem with transportation system we need to correct. But I think the other thing is that for every $1 million that's invested in a transportation project, national studies have shown that's about 19, you know, real family wage jobs that are ongoing during the life of that construction project for that $1 million. So this is an economic development issue. It is a jobs issue for Oregon. And right now, again, if we go out with a standard design, bid, build process, again, we tell them how to build the bridge, and under law, current law, the lowest responsive bidder is the firm that gets that project, whether they're from Florida or whether they're from Oregon. One of the things we haven't explored further, and we're starting to work with the Associated General Contractors and the contracting community, is in order to accomplish this level of investment in bridges and reconstruction in bridges in the time frame that we're talking about, we're going to have to do things dramatically different than we're talking about doing right now. In fact, I could see many fewer contracts, large numbers of these bridges being bundled together into a contract proposal. And I believe that if we ought to look at things other than just the standard low bid, I think we ought to look at a proposal basis that allows us to look at the qualifications of the contractor. Actually, in this case, it would be a consultant contractor team. We need to look at issues like cost. We need to look at issues like timeliness of completion of the work. We need to look at attaching conditions or preference to, again, encouraging Oregon contractors and workers to be used. And one of the things that we'll be talking about if a funding package comes forward is getting some clarity from the legislature and folks like you about how we do that, because I think that's critical to make sure that, again, we do have as much of this work stay in Oregon as possible, if I'm answering your question.
Of course, one of those balancing things, because it's preferences for Oregon bidders become barriers to Oregon contractors in other states when we start being too aggressive on that. You have retaliation, and it makes it difficult for Oregon contractors to bid outside the state if other states are perceiving Oregon as limiting their contractors' ability to bid in Oregon as well. So we'll let you worry about the details on that one, but that's just one of those things that gets more complicated the further you get into it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I could just to respond a little bit further, because I want to make clear, I'm not talking about giving a preference in terms of a percentage basis like some people would like to see us do in some things. I'm talking about that should be one of the considerations you do have when you look at a proposal to move forward with a package that allows you to make some decisions based on the most qualified firm, somebody will get it done, but also looking at how they're going to employ their workforce and get the job done.
Okay, we should move. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Barnhart.
On the same set of topics, I've had two sort of general comments from people who do this sort of work. One of them is a concern that the projects, and you've already mentioned this, are going to be bundled and get very large, and therefore local businesses may have a difficult time bidding on them. And I'm wondering what you can do to ameliorate, if you do, in fact, from an administrative point of view, plan to bundle these jobs into very large jobs, what you plan to do to ameliorate that so smaller businesses have some shot at some of the business. And I'm also wondering if you're looking at something other than at designing and then building later, if you're also looking at design-build aspects for the purpose of both speeding up construction and lowering costs.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, that's exactly what I guess I was trying to get at in this discussion. I mean, I wasn't being as articulate as I could be, but what I'm saying is the standard design, bid, and then build process that we use on most of our projects, bridge by bridge or project by project, clearly will not work on this magnitude of need and the desire to get the system brought up to speed as quickly as possible. What the things that we need to do is balance exactly those things that you're talking about. I think that if you look at some of the models, like again the Airport Max light rail extension, which was done by a large national firm, it was done it was a design build and essentially they fronted the money, in fact, for that particular project. But if you look at who was employed, that firm had very few people. They had a handful of folks employed from out of state managing that project, but they used all local contractors. And so the question is, obviously there's going to be a lot of fear and trepidation about what we're talking about, but if you look at something other than low bid, you can get to many of the issues you're talking about there to assure that those factors are taken into account if you need to move these projects along quickly, which is, I think, is what we're recommending to you in this bridge strategy. Am I being responsive, Representative?
So what you're really buying, what you bought with that project, and what you're really buying is management for a set of projects that you're working on.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnett, again, I forgot to mention one critical thing you said. What we're talking about is a design-build process. Essentially, you would be saying, here's a package of bridges. You're responsible for the design and the construction, and obviously warrant
of that. Okay, ask about that then, too. Those who incorporate some period of responsibility for repairs as well, then?
Mm-hmm. You bet. But instead of using the low bid, we'd use some sort of preference to weight things and to figure out the best combination to assure that we are accomplishing the things that you describe or avoiding the issues that you point out.
Did you want to talk about your letter here, the overview of financial change?
If you're ready, Mr. Chair.
You bet. You want to be done by 10:30.
Okay, we'll move along expeditiously.
Yeah, let's get on to that.
Financial change is just one component. I'm Mike Marsh from ODOT. There are other elements that we've been working on include things like contracting change, which we've been discussed briefly here, project management, and many other changes within the department to make sure we can deliver expeditiously on the revenues that have come in through the Oregon Transportation Infrastructure or Investment Act, as well as the potential for revenues that might come through this current session. But looking at the financial piece alone, there are several elements to policy that we're taking advantage of that are a significant change over the past. The first is looking at federal financing tools and making sure that we're aggressively using all the capabilities that exist in terms of the federal tools and looking at cash management, working with the Federal Highway Administration. The second is looking at the Innovative Finance Advisory Committee process, which was approved at the last session, allowing us to take a look at the shortage of traditional revenues and how we might use the private sector more aggressively in getting projects done, especially on complex projects. And thirdly is a road user fee task force, looking at the recognition of the declining source of revenue that's going to occur as we have increasing efficiency of vehicles and needing to have another revenue collection mechanism prepared. Looking first at federal financing tools, it used to be that basically highway funding was very structured. It was basically an 80% federal share and a 20% state share, and projects were funded in that way, and it was very structured without a lot of flexibility or creativity allowed. Recently, the Federal Highway Administration has changed that, and we have a lot of opportunities to use different kinds of tools to make sure that we're best using our revenues and having the best return on investment. The first one of those approaches I'd like to discuss is called advanced construction. Advanced construction allows for a state to move forward a project by using available non-federal funds as match and start the project using those non-federal funds and then convert it all to federal funds pretty quickly, thereby moving the project forward and allowing the state funds to be used elsewhere. That is a major change for us. It results in a need to manage the process much more closely because we're shifting funds significantly through the course of the project. What it means specifically for us in this next few years is that we're moving approximately $200 million worth of funds forward that would have been funds in the future that we can spend now using those state dollars. So that $200 million can go for some component of addressing the bridge concerns, some component of addressing modernization. I want to make sure it's clear that that's not very much compared to the $4.6 billion that we were talking about earlier, but it's at least using our revenues that we have as aggressively as we possibly can and working with the federal government. It allows us to use the Federal Obligation Authority to manage the cash much more tightly and to use the flexibility of funding in a way that assists us in getting projects done more quickly. A second tool is called flexible match, and flexible match allows us to use private contributions or in-kind match or materials that maybe a local government or private sector or ourselves can use to get a project moving, even if we don't have the direct cash. So by using that program, it makes sure that we can use what's available in terms of resources beyond cash to move projects forward. A third example is tapered match, where the federal government has allowed us to move forward with a project, and rather than viewing that it's 80%, 20% in this particular year, it can be 100% federal on the first few years. So by using all that federal funds all up front, we can move the projects forward. We have to recognize, though, as we look at these kind of tools, that, in essence, a balloon payment is coming at the tail end of the process, which changes our budget process significantly in working with Ways and Means as well as other committees. There has to be a recognition that you have an ending balance or a reserve at the end of the biennium to make sure you have enough to pay back for those projects that are coming forward later on down the pike. But it does allow us to leverage the federal funds and to make sure that we're using our money as effectively as we can for those projects that are needing to be done immediately. And we have a good return on the investment because we're dealing with those projects when the cost is going up 10-15% a year on asphalt, as well as other costs that are going up significantly. And by using the money early, we can have a better return on that investment. There's also the test and evaluation program, which allows us to use federal funds to recognize that we have certain projects that are being done now and use those as the match for those federal projects. So we can go out and find a program or a project that's being done where the federal government would allow us to use that project as actual match for the federal project that's being funded in another site. So all those approaches are ones that recognize that we can use federal money more aggressively, and that we can have a better return on investment for the work that we're doing. At the same time, it requires us to plan our payout process very specifically. And when it was very clear and structured each year, it was very simple, and the budget was clear to show what was going out each year and each biennium. Now we're in a process where we must do that analysis in a very significant way to make sure the reserve is appropriate to pay the debt that's coming down the pike, as well as to make sure that when we do analysis of things such as the highway cost allocation study, which looks at heavy vehicles versus light vehicles, if you're looking at a project in one particular year and look at that structure of moving forward those federal funds, if you look at just state dollars, you're not recognizing the whole magnitude of what's happening over a period of time. So the highway cost allocation study, when we come back in a couple of weeks and work with Mr. Yates and others, we'll be talking about a different structure for the methodology of analysis because of that aggressive movement of federal funds that have to recognize a different structure for analyzing how we spend our dollars. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move on to the Innovative Finance Advisory Committee briefly. We do have a report on that subject, and we'd be happy to bring in that report or give it to the members, or even for that matter, Jim Witte, who's in the room, can come in and give a major presentation on the subject if you like when there's time. But we wanted to give you a basic perspective about what's going on with that because it does relate to our financing and it is one of our major tools. The Senate Bill 966 last session allowed for the Innovative Finance Advisory Committee, and it was appointed to take a look at this issue of how we can get out and deal with complex, large projects when we don't have the revenues to get those kind of projects done. And the Innovative Finance Advisory Committee appointed had several outside folks from private sector to come in and look at how this can work in terms of venture capital, how you aggressively get the entrepreneurial spirit engendered to come in and seek these projects, how we can make sure we use the private sector in a much more efficient way and meet their kind of needs in terms of business planning to get them interested in doing these kind of projects. So they went through a process of establishing criteria, looking at possible financing methods. They have established a bill coming forward, which is Senate Bill 772, which is still going through the process of drafting, to outline ways to look at changes in the statute, ways to deal with changes in contracting procedure, like we mentioned a few minutes ago. Examples of those are listed in the handout. I'll just touch on a couple. The pre-qualification methods are looking at a change of the process, also looking at how you get an unsolicited bid instead of going through an RFP process, how you can respond to the private sector when they want to come forward with a proposal, how you can deal with that legally and make sure that we're both protecting the competitive process as well as making sure we're getting a good deal out of what's being proposed. Looking at how we might use the state's eminent domain process more aggressively in this way. Federal financing programs, I touched on several just now. There are others, which right now on the basis of our return on investment, we don't see them as having much potential. But when you move to public-private partnerships, they may. Things like Garvey bonds, which allow you to use federal bonding authority. If we've maximized our state bonding authority and we're trying to get a major project done working with the private sector, it's possible that Garvey bonds would be something that would be appropriate for us, as well as bi-state agreements that allow us to look at things that go across states and bring in the private sector in something that serves both states, say Oregon and Washington or others. the bottom line for the Innovative Finance Group is that we have to look at all our tools as aggressively as we can by involving the private sector and making sure that we do it in a way that's responsible and representing the taxpayer well. We're using all our tools effectively. Mr. Chair, unless there's a question about that one in particular, I'll move on to the Road User Fee Task Force for a few brief comments. And attached to your handout is the executive summary from the Road User Fee Task Force report. We can get this information to you if you'd like to have more detail. I just want to touch on it for a few moments to mention the purpose and what's coming out. It's a recognition, again, of the declining revenue that is coming from the gas tax and recognizing that with increasing efficiency there will be a plateauing and eventually a reduction in gas tax coming into the state. So they looked at the issue of a design for a new revenue collection mechanism and trying to determine how this process ought to work most efficiently. And looking at the current situation, we see that fuel tax revenue is the bulk of what's coming into the Oregon Department of Transportation. It's about 70% in 2002 of the total road budget came in through this mechanism. And we want to make sure that we're looking at how to use technology to most effectively bring in the fuel, bring in the revenue in place of the fuel efficiency issues that are challenging us. There's a lot of review that's been done and a lot of estimation of what's going to happen and what the timeline for market share increase for hybrids and electric vehicles and what this is going to do in the near term as well as the long term. But it's generally agreed that within a few years we're expecting about 10% of the market to be this type of vehicle. That's a major impact on our revenue source. It obviously needs to be something that we're planning towards rather than waiting to have it happen to us. So in looking at that and the fact that those revenues will plateau and eventually drop off, the task force looked aggressively at different alternatives of ways to receive the revenue and ways to, have that revenue collected. Looked at about 28 different alternatives, trying to emphasize a user pay approach, and came up with one broad revenue source, which was the mileage fee approach. There are several others that were looked at in addition to that relating to specific geographic areas or specific kind of projects or specific uses. But that one relating to mileage fee was the one that was recommended and is moving forward. According to the amount, it needs to be done according to the amount of fuel that a user uses and the amount of driving on the road system that is done by the user, so it relates to replacing the fuel tax and coming in with a principal revenue source that relates to the amount of miles that are driven. Of course, this will take several years, and once we move through this kind of process, it will not be something that happens just over a couple of years, but rather there'd have to be a mechanism that allows for both to occur or over a transition period, which could be 10 to 20 years, according to the report. However, during that period of time, it would be very clear that folks are not paying both. That would be something that is in essence, ensuring that one is being paid and that folks are not increasing the amount of revenue comes into the Department of Transportation or to cities and counties, but rather it's a process that ensures that the same revenue-neutral recommendations come through without changing the level of revenues that are coming in. There are a lot of specific details about that process in terms of how the information is collected that is being worked through, and they're talking about a pilot as a way to get information about that to make sure they have good information before we move forward for a more broad approach to looking at this being applied generally within the state. Other options I'll just touch on briefly. Congestion pricing is one that's being looked at. We do have federal funds assisting with this project, and they're very interested in having us address the issue of congestion pricing and looking at how you can adjust rates according to system needs and system challenges where in urban areas. Also, tolling is one that's being looked at, but you have to have a lot of considerations in terms of how you use tolling, looking at whether there are alternative routes and giving people choice to be able to move more quickly by using a tolled area as compared to an alternative that would be less timely. And then lastly, a studded tire use fee, which of course isn't something that would be a system-wide kind of charge that would be expected to bring in a lot of revenue, but it's trying to recognize the damage that's being done now in terms of studded tires and looking at a way to deal with it in a way other than elimination of studded tires, but rather providing an incentive to having people make a decision that would reduce the amount of tire use by having an additional fee. Mr. Chair, those are the brief recommendations coming off of the Road User Fee Task Force. I think the bottom line to all these elements is that they provide alternatives for revenues coming into the state. They provide ways to make sure that we're using our monies in the best way to have a good return on investment for those revenues as they come in and we're using them. but they do not address the major size of the issues of revenue concern that we talked about previously with the bridge discussion that preceded me. I'm open to any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? We do need to move on, but if we have a couple questions, we'll take them quickly. All right, thank you. I want to thank you all for being here today. It's good background for us. We hope that we will be getting our hands on some transportation funding package later this session, and so this is good background to have as to why we're doing what we're doing. And look forward to seeing you again then. But appreciate the background you've given us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Olivia.
You should be. Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Olivia Clark. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for TriMet, and with me should have been Roger Martin. I think he's making copies of his testimony right now. But in any event, I know you only have a few minutes.
We'll give you time.
I had probably a 30-minute PowerPoint, which I reduced down to about 5 pages here. So what I wanted to do was to give you some sense of where TriMet fits in the whole transportation picture, and Roger can give you the sort of big picture across the state. We're clearly the exception when it comes to transit in the state because of our largesse and because of the other the roles that we play, the multiple roles in the metropolitan area. TriMet is actually a creature of the state. It was established in 1969 when the Rose City Transit Company went broke, along with a lot of other public transit organizations or private sector companies across the country. We serve almost the whole county area, the urbanized portions, which is about 600 square miles. We have about 100 bus routes, soon to have 43 miles of MAX once the next interstate line opens, 21 park and rides, and then about 38 lots that we share with movie theaters, churches, and other retail establishments. I'm happy to report that I think we're beginning to understand what really is successful in terms of increasing ridership, because we've been experiencing increased ridership for the last 9 years steadily at about 5% per year. The Portland metropolitan area is about 29th in size in the country, and yet our ridership is 13th in the country, which is pretty remarkable. And what's also interesting is that every year we do a attitude and awareness survey. Who's riding, why do they ride, that kind of thing. And about 80% of the people that ride TriMet are choice riders, people who have a car or could get a car but actually choose to ride TriMet. And that's taking out students and taking out people who have or can't drive.
What percent?
It's about 80% choice riders. That's different than, for example, Los Angeles or some of the other large metropolitan areas that have mostly transit-dependent ridership. I'll skip ahead. Just let you know that there's an expectation in the metropolitan area that TriMet, in our regional transportation plan, in order to keep up with growth and deal with congestion and air quality issues, there's an expectation that we have a service increase every year of about 1.5%. Currently, we project that we should be able to keep up with that. That's where we are. But given population growth, Metro now expects us to double that, to grow to 3 to 4% service growth a year. We're not going to be able to do that currently. And given the downturn in the economy, we have, because of our productivity improvement process, which I'll explain to you, we've been able to just hold tight on service right now. 3 years ago, TriMet engaged in a productivity improvement process. We consulted Arthur Anderson before all the troubles, and Boeing and some other private sector folks on how to retool our business in order to look for efficiencies. We work directly with the frontline workers to retool the way we do work, the way we maintain the buses, the way we idle the buses, and actually it saved TriMet about $10 million in the last year or 2 years. We expect to continue that. It's changed the culture of TriMet. We are thinking that we'll be able to actually find more productivity improvements to save additional dollars. And someday when you have more time, I have a great video, a 10-minute video that actually I've been showing in other committees that are interested in government procedures, how TriMet's been able to do that. And it's really a model for the country in terms of productivity improvements. I threw in a couple of slides here, not any information, but we are very important when it comes to air quality in the metropolitan area. You may know that the Portland metropolitan area is just really up against the federal air quality attainment requirements. We're just staying in attainment with the federal requirements, and TriMet is a key component of that. Because of our ridership, we estimate that we probably save the equivalent of about 4.2 tons of precursors to smog, basically. That's important both to health, but also on the economic development side, in that the way the Federal Clean Air Act is written, if we go out of attainment with the federal standards, it's the industry that suffers. So what we're doing is helping to create capacity for the growth of industry. In fact, that 4.2 tons that we estimate we remove of smog-producing chemicals is the equivalent of, I think, about 9 Intels. Intel being the cleanest high-tech industry in the country, and probably about 19 Tektronix, which is important both in terms of health and economic development. Clearly, we help with congestion. On the west side, the MAX, it's estimated that if everyone who rode the west side MAX at peak hour were to get on Highway 26, which you know they wouldn't, but hypothetically, if they did, we're actually removing the equivalent of 1.2 lanes on each side, and that's actually using an ODOT metric. I think it's approximately the same for the I-84 and the east side MAX as well, roughly the same calculation. In terms of funding, I know you've been focusing on transportation finance. We are largely financed by the payroll tax, and that is a creature of statute. The payroll tax was selected. Actually, Roger Martin has the whole story because I think he chaired the committee that actually took this action back in about 1969 or 71. The payroll tax was selected as the financial mechanism to support mass transit districts in Oregon, and it was established in the statute at 0.6%. It's been that way since 1969, and that provides TriMet with about half of its operating budget. Right now it's about $146 million. The rest of our budget is made up from about 25% fare recovery, which is pretty good against the national average. We do a very good job. And then 25% of the rest of the budget is a variety of things. A large part of that is federal grants that we receive, some formula money, some enterprise activity, advertising, a variety of different things. I got in here a slide on the federal funds, which is very important to us, and in fact you'll be hearing more about that in the future. We're coming up, I'm sure the ODOT told you this, that we're coming up upon the 6-year reauthorization cycle of the Federal Surface Transportation Act. And what TriMet normally does, and the metropolitan region joins together and submits a list of earmarks to our congressional delegation, TriMet expects out of that package to compete at the national level for probably $400 million worth. That's roughly what our what we've been receiving, $400 million out of that 6-year cycle. And that's primarily to pay for light rail. And this next cycle will be competing again for those discretionary dollars. It's important to understand, too, that those are discretionary dollars. They're only for transit. We're not competing with the roadside or with freight. We make a contribution in terms of the overall transportation picture. But the funds that we're going for are funds that could go to Atlanta or Los Angeles or Salt Lake City or wherever. And TriMet has been very successful at bringing those dollars in. There is a match that's required. In fact, the federal government requires three things when we go for those federal dollars. They require that we have a good project, which we compete very, very well in terms of ridership, land use planning, all the different things the feds are looking for. They want to know we have local match, which is something that we have been raising locally, and that match is changing. I threw one of the slides in here is on the interstate max. That match with the federal government has been about 70-30 or around about there. We've been very fortunate. West side max was about 80-20, actually. Now we're getting down to the 60-40 match. It's possible that the federal government will go 50-50 match. I don't know. But we have the responsibility in the metropolitan area to raise the local match. The third thing they look for is, can you operate something in a 20-year time horizon? Because the federal government wants to know that their investment is a good investment, and it's going to last. It's not going to, you know, close up and be a waste of money. So that's the third thing that we'll look for. And at this point, we will not be able to show with our current revenues that we will be able to actually provide those operating dollars into the future for another light rail line. And we'll be coming back to talk to you about that at a future time. But in a nutshell, that's TriMet. That's our revenue picture. And I know that Roger wanted to say a couple things about the transit situation statewide.
Let's bring him up. Stay there, Olivia, in case you have some questions when Roger is done. Roger Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Roger Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Transit Association, and I know the time is short, and I'll try to be brief. I've distributed a two-page executive summary of a study we've just completed. And first of all, the Transit Association has about 50 members. 12 are the so-called fixed route systems, such as TriMet, but it very quickly goes from TriMet down to Lane Transit, down to Salem Area Transit, and we get much smaller. TriMet is by far the largest system in the state, but we go on down to the series of senior and elderly and disabled transportation facilities around the state that are a variety of people. Cities do it, private nonprofits do it, and these folks are always at the very low end of the tax or the feed system, and they're hurting. And I just want to briefly give you a little background on that. You will notice on the summary that I gave you down towards the bottom of the first page, the fixed fleet, there's probably about 1,000 vehicles in the state. Look at the average age of some of those. One-third of the fleet has more than 500,000 miles on it. Now, buses are built to last longer than automobiles, but once you get to that level, the cost of maintenance goes up. We continually need to replace the buses, and many of our systems are operating buses that are 16 to 20 years old and desperately need to replace them. Most of that funding comes from the federal government, but there's a local match that's required. At some point in the future, when the state is a little better off, we want to talk about the state perhaps setting up a long-term fund where we can use that to match the federal program, but we know what the financial situation is. I do want to say to you that unlike perhaps other organizations, we have always valued tremendously TriMet's participation in the OTA because TriMet brings to the table some things that no one else can bring. They're vastly experienced. They don't need the Oregon Transit Association to fill out federal grants to train people and so forth, but they in turn provide trainers. They go all over the state training our drivers in small systems, teaching everything from insurance to proper routing, dispatch and all those kind of things. They've been absolutely perfect about that. The latest thing they've done is that TriMet has loaned to everybody, including the Federal Transit Administration, an individual who is a grant writer to assist the Region 10 office in Seattle in filling out the voluminous paperwork that has to be done to match the federal funds. We couldn't get it done. And I can only tell you, our folks out in the rural areas are very unsophisticated. I spent the last day and a half trying to get our congressional requests together. They have to be in Washington, D.C. by today. And it's like pulling teeth to get these people to understand. They've asked for $100,000, $200,000, $400,000, but they've got to fill out the paperwork or the congressional offices can't get it for them. And I've had Congressman Walden's office call me three times saying the city of Bend hasn't got their form in yet for the $250,000 they want. And I keep calling her, and she's, well, it's on my desk. I'm going to get to it, but it's difficult. The one thing I do want to point out, and I'll quit, is that the effect of some of the things that you've had to participate in. The freezing of the cigarette tax for the last quarter of this year has had a profound effect. You remember that we've set aside a total of $5.4 million for the May 15th economic forecast. The effect of that has been larger systems like TriMet, Lane Transit, and others have enough reserves or other money they can continue to provide the service. But what we feared would happen is now happening. Some of the smaller systems are shutting down as of April 1st. Linn County, that receives SDF funds from the state of Oregon, as you said, our biggest recipient is the little Sweet Home Senior Center in Sweet Home. They have no reserves, and the county is not going to foot the bill. So as of April 1st, they're stopping all service. This is going to start to happen. It'll happen in Prineville. It'll happen in Joseph, Oregon. We're hearing from small systems that are utterly without any reserve to be able to do anything. Even the system in Representative Hobson's area, Tillamook Transportation District, have enough reserves. They're going to continue to fund their system. But we live in utter fear that what may happen in the Ways and Means Committee and elsewhere is that the 2-cent cigarette tax that goes to fund all this may be taken in the next biennium. I want to enlist your support to try not to do that, because if we shut it down, we're going to shut down senior transportation centers and handicap transportation all over the state. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to give you this information.
Okay. Thanks for that little yellow flag. Thanks for the information this morning, Olivia.
Thank you.
Mr. Warner, thank you for joining us. I wish we had more time to talk about this. I know we will, though, because we hope to see you all back before us on your various issues when we have bills in front of us to maybe help. So with that, committee, we will be adjourned, and have a good day.